Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
Coming up on this week's show, are Gen Z falling in love with retro gaming?
A legendary Sega franchise is back.
And we have an exclusive chat with the former Commodore managing director, Kelly Sumner.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our sponsor, our good friends at Bitmap Books. And of course, this week's podcast, definitely one for the Amiga heads. Have you seen their amazing book, Commodore Amiga, A Visual Compendium? A real celebration of the titles that defined the Amiga. From the early days of Defender of the Crown, Barbarian, Marble Madness, and then through Rainbow Islands, all the big titles we loved, Speedball, Worms, Cannon Fodder in there as well, spanning more than 420 pages. A must-have for fans of the Amiga. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 468, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for the podcast that every single Friday takes you on a nostalgic journey back to the golden age of video games and technology. And of course, brings you up to speed with all the big happenings from the wonderful world of retro from over the last 7 days and brings you veterans of the industry onto the podcast for a chat on every single show. Nice to have Joe Fox back as well. I heard a little rumour that you were sunning in the Bahamas. You had a lottery win last week. Have you spent up now?
Absolutely not. quite the opposite. Unfortunately, life just got in the way.
Well, you need to watch your back because James did an amazing job.
I know. You know what? Like, I think that's the second or third time I've missed a show in the last kind of like however many years I've been doing this full time with you guys. And I always worry.
Are they going to replace me?
They can't replace Joe.
Irreplaceable. Nice to be back there, mate.
But no, thank you very much, James, for coming on at such short notice. Cracking episode.
Well, you have picked a big week to come back because we have got the first of a two-part exclusive interview. Now, this one is one of the biggest interviews I think we've ever done. 2 hours long, this one, Ravi.
Yeah, so we're going to be running each part on each episode. So the first part is going to be about Commodore and the Amiga. And how excited were you when I told you I got this guest, Dan, and that he was going to come on the show and do it for this long?
Well, this was someone who I used to read about in Amiga magazines back when I first got my machine. I got my Amiga 500 Plus, the Cartoon Classics pack, for Christmas 1991. And then, obviously, back then, you know, finding software in the early days before I realized that my friends could maybe help me out. The only way that I would find out about what's happening in the world of the Amiga, you know, before the internet and everything, was by buying magazines. And I remember, you know, religiously buying stuff like, or my dad did for me, stuff like Amiga Format, Amiga Shopper, CU Amiga Magazine. And this guy was always the face of Commodore in that era, in 1992, because he was the managing director of Commodore UK. Now, this is Kelly Sumner. Now, he had a really long career at Commodore, didn't he, spanning from 1979 to 1993.
Yeah, that's a huge period of time working there. And he started as a trainee electronics engineer and then kind of went through the ranks. So, you know, a sales support coordinator, then marketing manager, retail product sales director, and then managing director at the end. And Kelly didn't just, you know, stay in Commodore as well. He went on to a company that we all kind of recognize, which was Take-Two Interactive. So they merged with Game Tech,
Yep.
And then there was a certain game, you know, Grand Theft Auto 3.
Never heard of it.
that kind of came out because BMG also got involved there. And that whole 3D world of Grand Theft Auto was launched, and that was absolutely huge. You know, the world's biggest series at the moment, and getting Rockstar on board. Kelly was a huge part of that, and that's what the second interview is about next week. But also Guitar Hero, which is another absolutely huge brand. So it's a really interesting history, but in this one, it's a deep, deep dive into that world of Commodore and all those products that came out. You know, some amazingly successful, some not so much.
Yeah, I mean, he started when, you know, he mentioned about he was doing the engineering, training engineering. He was basically the only guy, the sole engineer in the UK that was repairing VIC-20s and Commodore 64s for
the
a time.
Only guy, yeah, in a room with a broom. Yeah, yeah. It's just, that's mad.
Yeah, then obviously, like you said, he went through the ranks, and then he was a guy who was behind the Commodore 64 GS console, you might remember, and then talked about the CD TV. And also, he probably had one of the hardest jobs as a basically a person who was a spokesperson for Commodore at the time. He had to announce the death of the Amiga 500 and kind of sell the idea of the Amiga 600 onto people. So at the time, that was a bit of a controversial choice. We find out what Kelly really thought of that machine.
And also lots of inside stories about Mehdi Ali as well, the infamous boss of Commodore at the time.
Yeah, who was a bit of a difficult character by all accounts. So it's interesting to read this because, yeah, I mean, obviously we're huge fans of Commodore and the Amiga, had loads of other people from the company on as well. But like I said, when I first got my Amiga, Kelly was like the first kind of figurehead of Commodore I remember reading about. So really interesting to hear some stories. And I think the first time he's done a podcast and talked about
it. I remember seeing him on Games Master back in the days. Yeah, that was quite cool.
Which I'm going to put that in the show notes if you want to see Kelly's appearance on Games Master, something that you'll find that you probably rather forget, but, you know, it was rather cool, I think, that a managing director did that. So the first of a epic two-part interview with Commodore Managing Director Kelly Sumner coming up on the podcast this week. By the way, if you want to see the full thing right now, if you can't wait till next week, we're actually going to put the full interview as a video podcast up for our patrons as well.
Yeah, we're experimenting with video.
Yeah,
and hopefully this will be a good way, because, you know, people say podcast nowadays,
yeah,
and they kind of mean video, don't they? And we get so many guests that come and turn their cameras on. We're like, no, turn it off, we're audio only. But actually, I think it's time we slowly made this transition.
Yeah, so I'm going to check that out, the full 2 hours. If you can't wait till next week, join us on Patreon, all the details at theretrohour.com. But of course, first half of the show is when we bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last week. And every week it seems like another Dreamcast story. It's getting so much love at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, honestly. You know what? I put this story in, and, you know, we always like to have like a hardware story kind of like in here. So, but every single week, there is definitely something going on with the Dreamcast, whether it is hardware or whether it's, you know, a new game for it or whatever. But it just seems like there's more and more people trying to bring the Dreamcast into like the modern world and compete with like the likes of the PS5 and the Xbox Series X and put all these crazy features in it. So obviously, there's been lots and lots of games getting brought back online for the Dreamcast recently, you know, people playing Half-Life and stuff like that online on it. We've covered over the last couple of weeks. But that as interesting as that is, you know, on its own, we've now got a guy who has developed Dreamcast cloud save support through a virtual online VMU.
So what this is a thing called DreamPipe, which is a service which runs through the browser. So what you actually need is a DreamPi, which is like a little adapter kit so that you can actually get your Dreamcast back online. And mm-hmm. the DreamPi is quite cheap. You know, it's like 26 quid.
It's a Raspberry Pi, isn't it, really?
Pi, essentially, that acts as the modem and then like acts as a bridge. But you don't need to mod your Dreamcast at all. So you just use a browser to access this portal, and then you can save your files, upload them or download them via the Dreamcast browser. So, you know, you don't need the memory card. You can just store it within the cloud virtually, which would be amazing.
And then does it play from the cloud, does it, while you're online?
Well, you'll be able to download them. So you go onto the browser, load up your save file.
And then you download,
onto your memory card, I assume.
Oh, wow.
That's the way.
I guess it means that your high scores and your basically your save data, your save points in games are preserved online. So it means, you know, if your VMU dies or you lose it or it breaks, then you've got these save states preserved online, like a modern console does, which I think, you know.
But also, like, DreamPipe adds extra services in there. So it has leaderboards within there as well. So, you know, that could be an active thing that's starting to happen. But also it has a DLC archive. So it's got an archive of all of the old DLC content that was available. So, you know, there's a lot of extra stuff you can do by just getting it online with this DreamPi. And this is just an added kind of feature in there. And it's, you know, built for compatibility with that browser.
I mean, I did a YouTube video probably going back about 5 years ago now where I was playing around with the Dreamcast web browser and kind of seeing how capable it is to kind of surf the web these days, as you'd imagine. Not that capable.
No YouTube videos on there.
No Facebook or anything like that. Yeah. But I mean, it was a cool experiment to do. But I think that was a bit of a novelty when I did that in the video. But now having services like this that actually can use that technology for something that kind of brings us, like you said, Joe, kind of these modern comforts to retro systems, I think it's pretty cool. It's a great community as well.
Yeah, it's nice cloud saving because I have that on Steam. When I use that, I save stuff to the Steam cloud. Mm. And it's the same with like PSN and stuff, isn't it? The PlayStation Network, and it saves it to the cloud, I assume. I've not played PlayStation for years.
of them do these days.
That's it. But my one worry is that this is a free service that's hosted by someone, and if that goes down, you might lose access to them. But I'm sure these folks are going to keep it up because they want to keep this service alive and keep it going. And I just love the idea of old servers bringing back functionality to old systems.
DreamPipe's awesome as well if you combine it with the DreamPi, because I mean, the DreamPi, you can play a lot of games that only supported the Dreamcast 56K modem. Because I've got the broadband adapter for my Dreamcast, which is actually really rare to get hold of. But there's only about 4 games that support that, I think. So actually these days, if you want to play your Dreamcast online, you're actually better off using a DreamPi, like a Raspberry Pi with a little modem adapter. You need like a voltage converter to bring it up to line, you know, so it's telephone line. But that's by far the best solution if you do want to get your Dreamcast online these days, and the cheapest. Like you said, you know, 30, 40 quid, you can have a nice setup.
Yeah, there's a site, it's sold out in some places, but rightsprite.co.uk seems to sell a little DreamPi kit.
Well, nice to see the Dreamcast getting some more love, so keep it going. And we'll link that up if you want to read more in this week's show notes. Now, we did mention before that we do have a Patreon, and every week on the podcast, we actually do like an extra 10, 15 minutes of news stories just for our patrons. So if you do like the news section of the podcast, good way to get a bit more. And last week, I think we'll recap this for everyone just quickly, because obviously Joe wasn't here, and a lot of people wouldn't have heard the patrons area of the podcast. But there was a survey that was done in North America that revealed that 14% of North Americans still play video game systems released before the year 2000, which kind of blew our tiny minds. And then the survey also revealed that 15% of Americans listened to music on cassette tape in the last year, the same amount of watching a movie on VHS.
Still use Laserdisc. That was the one that shot me.
Laserdisc movies, 3% of them as well. 11% of American households still use a fax machine last year in 2024.
Which is, considering how big a country it is, it's insane. You know,
That's a huge, millions and millions of people. But not wanting to be outdone, there's been another survey done, this time here in the UK. And it turns out that apparently 1 in 4 Generation Z Brits own a retro gaming console. Now, you work with the young'uns, Ravi. What is Generation Z then? What kind of ages is that?
Generation Z is 1997 to 2012, so it's 13 to 28. Mm. Millennials is us lot, which is 29 to 44. I don't know, Dan, who might be Gen X.
I think I'm on the board. Yeah, I'm a Zennial.
But interestingly, I've seen like on YouTube and stuff so much interest in the older consoles and physical media as well, physicality and you know, this whole retro trend at the moment. I think it's awesome. When I was younger, I got into like older technology and stuff, and was playing on stuff that was kind of, you know, I got into reel to reel players and stuff like that. Yeah. You know, long before I was born. So it's good to see. Interesting to see what they say about Generation Y as well, which is under 13 years old at the moment. I've noticed that I work with kids, like you said, and I noticed that, you know, they're really like confused about old technology. Mm. Yeah, I bought a Nokia phone in to show them, and they said, "Why have you got a trap phone, sir?"
Wow. This survey was done. This is interesting because this was a survey that was done of 2,000 Brits who are aged in that Generation Z age range. It said 13 to 28. Apparently, this was a report commissioned by Pringles, who were promoting a retro console clinic in London where they did free repairs for consoles and handhelds. Why are we just hearing about this now? Yeah. This is only on for 2 days, apparently. That would have been handy.
Maybe get some free Pringles as well.
Oh, hopefully, yeah.
Fix my Game Gear in and give me some Pringles.
What a day that would be. But yeah, so apparently they did this survey, and it turns out that 66% of those they asked, which, you know, it's only 2,000 people, but apparently 24% of them now own a retro gaming console. Now, it's interesting, the reasons they give is 89% of it said retro games give them a break from the internet. And they said that 74% of them said that nostalgic games are more relaxing than current games. And a big bunch of these are actually buying them, despite never actually owning them or even being alive when these systems were new. So I think there is definitely, you know, because I think of my little nephew, who's 11 years old now. You know, he's obviously younger than Generation Z. He is Gen Y. But it's, Well, no, Gen Alpha that would be, wouldn't it? The new generation.
Oh, yeah, Gen Y. Alpha. Yeah,
so. Gen Y is millennials. But Gen Alpha. So he's never known life without the internet.
Yeah, and I think the pacing of the games are completely different. But also there's a lot of game series out there at the moment where they have their roots and they have, like, you know, a whole history of games that you can check out and check out the line. I remember when Final Fantasy VII came out, I said, right, I need to go and check out all the previous Final Fantasies before, and went and sought after those when I was younger.
It's interesting, though, because on here, some of the comments are like, well, it doesn't actually define in this study what a retro gaming console is. And one of the comments is, yeah, you know, to Gen Z's, the PlayStation 4 is retro.
Not to be unfair to Pringles, I don't think they're the biggest surveying board or official people.
You think it's, this might be like, made up to get a headline, rather?
Yeah, it's not the census, is it?
What do you think, Joe?
I think Ravi's right. I don't think Pringles are the... No, I do agree with Ravi. I think a lot of it will come down to... You hear a lot about like how nothing's new in 2025 and 2024. Everything's either remakes, remasters, or a sequel, especially in games and in films. Like, we're seeing some new IPs and stuff like that. But, you know, you look at, like, God of War comes to mind. Like, you know, absolutely huge franchise. But if you look back, there's been, what, like, 7 of them, you know, going back to the PS2 now. And if somebody who's, like, in their mid-20s, or like early 20s and like, God of War is my favourite game, then yeah, they might go, actually, you know what, I'm going to go get a PS2 or a PS3 and play some of the older ones.
Like Doom as well and stuff.
Doom,
Metal Gear Solid and, you know, these series.
Sonic Mario even.
Even GTA as well.
GTA. You know, I do hear a lot of people with GTA, they tend to go back to like number 3 or San Andreas and stuff. They don't go all the way back, but that's still, you know, number 3 is still, what, 23, 24 years ago. Like, and if they want to play it on original hardware, etc., then obviously they're going to have to get a PS2. But then also I wonder, when they say a retro console, could they mean, you know, these, like, you know, the Raspberry Pis or the, you know, the emulation consoles and stuff like that? Like, you know, it could mean anything like that as well. You know, obviously this could never happen, but I would love to see a much, much, much bigger, wider scale, like... survey of it, because I work with a few younger people as well, mainly university graduates who have become like first line engineers where I work, and a lot of them, not to poo-poo on their knowledge or anything like that, because why would they know a lot of stuff I don't know, you know, with the modern world, but they ain't got a clue like what some of the older consoles are and stuff like that. And I'm 35 and they literally see me as like the oldest man ever. Like
Grandpa Joe.
Yeah, they see me as dad. Like, honestly, like it's crazy. And it's like, I've got a girl who works for me directly for me and she's 21.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I'm not quite old enough to be her dad, but she definitely comes to me and asks me dad questions.
Like, you know, I've noticed if you kind of try to get out of the algorithm in YouTube and get into different areas, you can actually find a lot of younger gamer channels that are collecting some of the older stuff and, you know, people that are like 20 years younger than me and stuff. And it's really cool to see. It's quite encouraging as well, because it does make me think, you know, all this stuff that's being done at the moment, that there'll be a future for it.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, even going back to my childhood, I like movies and music and TV shows from, like, you know, I used to watch a lot of them from the 60s on TV when I was a kid. So you're like,
Man,
you know,
from 20 Uncle, years before. Mate, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, Land of the Giants, you know, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, all those cheesy 60s sci-fi stuff. You watch my mum and love them. But apparently this survey goes on. It said even more recent technologies coming back into vogue. DVD players, 20% of retro hardware sales. DVD's retro. Digital camera sales, apparently. 55% of Generation Z saying they'd rather take photos with a digital camera than a smartphone.
I saw this genius thing. It was like a kind of like, have the 90s experience. And it was like a digital camera kind of theme like the 90s. But all they'd done is just put a really cheap rubbish camera in there. And I was like, that's a good way of making money. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, some really cheap they bought like from AliExpress or something. But yeah, apparently they reckon it might be a general interest in 90s and noughties fashion and music coming back into trend.
Oh yeah, I've definitely seen that with the young people. They're all going around with baggy jeans and all of that. And yeah,
My wife bought baggy jeans the other day and I was like, fair. Like,
coming back. Yeah. Yep. What goes around comes around. But like you said, Joe, it would be nice to see a bigger survey, more than just 2,000 people. Maybe reach out to, like, you know, Walkers or McCoy's or something.
Get all the Chris companies involved.
We'll cover it on the podcast. So we're going to read more about that. I'll shove that in the show notes as well. Now you can tell Joe's back when there is a retro horror title in the news.
Don't know what you're on about.
This one looks right up your street, this one. This looks really interesting, actually. I like the look of this. A new game called Flesh Made Fear.
Yeah, this caught my eye earlier this week. So this is going to be due to release on Steam only at the moment, at the end of 2025. And it's made by a California-based developer, single-handedly by the looks of things, Michael Casillo, who's actually made quite a few horror games over the last couple of years, which I need to go check out. I've not played any of these or heard of these games, but Terror, Oakheart, Suffer the Night, Weeping Falls Massacre, and Meatsaw, all very much up my street. But why is Joe talking about a modern Steam survival horror game? Well, it's got a PS1 style graphics, which I am just an absolute sucker for. Those polygons and pixels. Very, very, very Resident Evil original looking.
I'd say also Alone in the Dark.
And Alone in the Dark, 100%. Yeah. And Silent Hill to an extent, but with kind of like modern controls.
And it's got like Max Payne style comic cut-ins.
It's definitely got like a, it's like sort of cell shaded but then like pixelated, and you've said Max Payne, I can't unsee it. But it looks absolutely fantastic, you know, the stylization of it and stuff. And then in terms of the camera angles, it is that fixed camera, you know, from the isometric kind of view. And then it looks quite action orientated, you know, quite fast paced and stuff.
A lot of explosions,
lots of zombies getting their heads popped off. Very typical kind of like zombie apocalypse in like a, you know, kind of American dreary kind of Western town.
There's a certain look for it where, like,
if you
get a graphics card and the palettes are wrong or something, and it's kind of looks like it's deliberately done, or, you know, you have the hue really high up and the contrast quite down.
This is the kind of game that would scare me, and I'd put the brightness up really high and ruin the look of it.
Yeah, that's it.
But yeah, really excited for this one. I really, really like the look of it. It's still got puzzles in there and everything, so they haven't gone completely modern with it. No news on whether it's going to be a Kickstarter or not, but it does say on the trailer Kickstarter at the bottom. right at the end. Right. So I imagine he will launch it for crowdfunding. And I'm hopeful, because obviously I'm a console gamer, that, you know, usually when these things do well, they tend to do a stretch goal for like PS4, PS5 or Switch.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these indie games come out on those consoles. Don't tend to come out on Xbox too much these days, unfortunately. But I really, this, yeah, totally, totally, totally up my street. It does feel like every week I say Dreamcast and every week there's some classic survival horror.
Just the trend in gaming right now, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm hoping as well, end of 2025, it'd be nice to see a Halloween release for this, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just look spooky. Help. And I've been all about spooky games recently again, so I've been playing the Silent Hill 2 remake and just finished the Dead Rising remaster. So, yeah, definitely feeling these kind of games at the moment.
Flesh Made Fear. So I want to see the trailer. I'll put that in the show notes as well. We'll keep an eye on that one. Now, in a second, I'm going to be talking about a really interesting new handheld console. Also, a legendary Sega title that is back. Just a reminder as well, patrons, it is going to be our monthly hangout this coming Sunday. If you haven't joined the patrons hangout before, these are always a giggle.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely love them. It's always good to get together on a Sunday night. You know, Sunday night, you never really do anything, and it's good to have a chat as well. It gets me hyped, you know. It marks the end of the weekend, but also we've got some really cool nerdy information that you get. And the problem is, people tell me about things that I'm like, oh, eBay, maybe I'll get that, maybe I'll order that. It can be dangerous in that way, but it's really nice to get together with everybody. And we share so much information in there. That's had a lot of people with problems, with issues with some of their machines, and people have said, if you tried this out, this will resolve it. And it's quite a good troubleshooting thing as well as a social.
I've got some CD32 issues I'll be asking the guys about on Sunday night. So, stand by. But it is basically a virtual users group. That's what we call it. So if you want to join us, all patrons are welcome. So if you sign up right now, you get an invite to that this coming Sunday evening from 8 p.m. till 10 p.m. UK time. We do it last Sunday of the month normally, so 23rd of February. That's coming up. If you want to join us on Patreon, all the details are at theretrohour.com. We have got a couple of new patrons to welcome as well. So I'll let you guys welcome them into the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, and that is the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame.
Who we got then?
A massive thank you to Marcus
and Vijay,
who both joined us on Patreon over the last week. Your support is massively appreciated, and all the details, if you'd like to join our wonderful patrons community, are on the website right now, theretrohour.com. Have you guys got Kindles?
I don't, but my missus, well, she doesn't have a Kindle anymore. She has the Kindle app
on the phone.
But she did have one back in the day.
My missus has got a Kindle. Mm. I think I bought her about one Christmas, maybe 10 years ago. She used it on holiday once, and then it's gone in a drawer, never to be used again. I think she bought me one the following year.
I really want to get back into reading, babe.
Yeah. It's weird though, isn't it? Because I remember I remember buying my mum one. It was, you know, they were basically...
I've had one, yeah.
Yeah, for a couple of years it was always, because they're always under £100. It was always something that, you know, you buy your missus or your mum for Christmas. But I think the sales of them massively dropped off after a few years. And obviously they didn't really do for books what like the iPod did for music. You know, they didn't replace books. You know, there's still bookshops everywhere.
Which is good, I'd say, because I love my books, yeah.
It's weird how they never did, though, really, because, I mean, obviously they're a lot more convenient. You know, if you're going away, you can have your entire book library on a Kindle. I think there's still definitely uses for it.
Yeah.
But the thing that always really attracted me to them, I mean, I've got the Kindle app on my iPad, but kind of reading it on a standard LCD screen, for example, you do get eye fatigue. But obviously the big attraction to readers on Kindles was that e-reader e-ink that those devices use.
Yes, and I absolutely love e-ink. So e-ink, it's quite expensive to produce the screens. So, you know, screen sizes have been increasing with e-ink, and also quality. So there's a whole new thing called e-ink phones as well, which have started to come out. And, you know, you can actually do your phone functions on them. It's a bit slower than usual stuff. It's not going to be good for your 3D gaming or anything huge like that. But
I bet someone's got Doom running on a Kindle somewhere.
Oh yeah, you know, yeah, for sure. But it is functional, and also that whole thing about being able to read it, no screen glare, none of that. We see screens so much nowadays that you know, and they're all very, very bright, and we never used to like look at stuff that bright. I think it's great, e-ink. I'm a big fan of it, and I can't wait to get an e-ink phone. But this is totally different. This is a e-ink console, which also lends itself to books as well, but in a very different way.
Yeah, now this is the Ink Console, and this is from a company called Singular 9 Limited, and this is going to be launching on Kickstarter on the 1st of March. Now this is, it looks a bit like a Kindle, a device that, you know, has got a massive e-ink screen on there. I think the only difference looking at it is you've got the 7.5-inch screen, but you've got analog sticks and an analog stick and a button on the front of it as well. So this is designed for gaming, but it is a specific genre of gaming they're aiming at with this.
Yeah, so it's adventure games, but also in a kind of adventure book form. Mm. But they've got their own SDK, which makes it a bit more advanced than just, you know, choose your own adventure style. So, like, you know, they're talking about Zork here, The Hobbit, some of the original kind of great adventure text adventures. There'll maybe be a new way of kind of releasing these. So they've got a few concept games that they've released at the moment. And the whole thing about this is you can actually have an inventory, so you can use items within it, but you're still kind of scrolling through pages. There's pictures in there. So it's got that old kind of, you know, feel and slow vibe to how you're playing, but you've got these extra features. And also they're making the SDK available, which is going to be really cool because people can develop all kinds of different stories with this for this platform. I think the play date was e-ink as well, which was one of the consoles that we saw, you know, the one with the little kind of windy handle on the side, the play date. But also, I think the advantages of this as well is e-ink, the battery life, it's going to last a hell of a long time, you know, after a charge.
Yeah, I think I've got, like I said, that Kindle, it's been in my drawer for many years. I took it out after about 12 months and it still had charge. I was like, wow. So yeah, a lot less power than using an iPad or something like that. But yeah, so this is basically a hybrid of an e-reader and a games console, and aiming at adventure game fans. Now, we're talking like the real old school ones, which I did like. I mean, I remember playing stuff like Adventure, you know, the old Infocom games and stuff like that. And I think text adventures are really the closest thing that you can get to a book on a video game system.
Yeah. And I can imagine, like, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and then you had like a little custom Hitchhiker's feel on this. That would be absolutely amazing. You know, Don't Panic written on the back.
I twitch thinking about that game. And
Really tough. But it's got all kinds of implementations you could do from like BBS titles and all of this. I guess it just needs people to come on board and get involved and start porting it. But it is open source, which is excellent.
One thing I like about it as well is apparently the development kit for it, you don't need to know programming. Yeah. So it does mean that, you know, in my mind, that kind of opens it up to people that maybe had just written books or stories before, like authors who had no experience making a game.
Yeah, or also like, you know, indie authors or solo people who have never kind of done it before and they want to expand. And I think if you probably made a game on this, you know, you'd probably get a lot more attention because there's so many books going out at the moment. If you kind of added this interactive element in there, I'm sure like lots of people will get involved with your kind of world that you've been creating.
I've talked before on the podcast that me and my friend Gary actually tried to make an adventure game on the BBC Micro back at school. Maybe I could finally fulfill my dream.
Oh, was that that one where you do a text adventure? It's like you are lost in the swirling mist. Yeah, I did one as well. Yeah.
We were trying to do it in BBC Basic, got completely lost. but yeah, I mean, this looks really cool. I mean, obviously the one thing I initially thought is, well, if you're doing kind of type in adventure games, there's no keyboard on it. But actually the way they do it, it's more, which actually I think is probably a nicer way of playing text adventures. It gives you a multiple choice menu.
Yeah.
So at the bottom of the page, it will say, you know, for example, there's a couple of little options here on one of the screenshots they've mocked up, you know, use the coin, continue exploring, go north, go east. So rather than having to type in things and getting the syntax exactly right for the parser, which you often had to do back in the day, you know, instead of going go north, it'd have to be up or something stupid like that for it before it recognized
I think it's a really niche, like innovative idea, but also you know, the guy behind it, Dana, He's had previous companies like Green Boy Games, which was like a Game Boy development studio, but it had that kind of green tinge on every game. So I think it's all about like mastering a style, and this definitely seems like something unique for interactive fiction.
Yeah, and I really want to get back into that genre again. I've been playing some old, like, you know, type in adventure games recently, so I think, yeah, I'm really interested in this. So I think this might be one that I'll be
backing.
I think it
might be a good way to get kids into reading. You know, if they're bridging them from the consoles and the laptop screens, I mean, like, look, there's still interactive elements. Play around with this, and then you know, get a real book out, and like, it might be a good bridging method, the ink console.
And did you read the Choose Your Own Adventure books when you were a kid?
Oh yes, yeah.
Yeah, they were awesome. Remember, like, the Cave of Time and Hyperspace, the Forbidden Castle, stuff like that. So it would be awesome if, like, you know, stuff like that was brought
into
this.
I'd cheat quite a lot in them, but
yeah, same. Yeah. Oh, I didn't want to go there. Go back.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, this is going to be launching on Kickstarter March 1st. I've got a feeling this will be one that I back. So it looks really cool. So if I'm going to read more about that, the e-ink console, I will link that in the show notes as well. Now, something else I used to love as a kid, every time we went to Scarborough in the school summer holidays, made a beeline. Well, the Shinobi cabinet in the arcade. Always loved Shinobi. And nice to see that it's coming back. Old school style.
Yeah, I think this is the best direction they could have taken it in. Shinobi Art of Vengeance, which is going to be coming to all modern platforms on the 29th of August 2025. We saw the trailer for this released about a week ago. I think graphically, this looks absolutely fantastic. They've gone back to the roots of Shinobi.
No 3D nonsense in this.
Yeah, it's not 3D or anything like that. 2D. Graphically, they've gone for... It's like... I wouldn't say it's pixel. It's
like graphic novel style, isn't it?
Yeah, it's... What would you even say that is?
It's a hand-drawn kind of look, isn't it? Like yeah. Streets of Rage 4.
Yeah, so, like, which is interesting
prettier,
you said that.
I think,
it's coming from Lizard Cube, who worked on Streets of Rage 4. We were talking about this before the show. It was Lizard Cube and .mu who did Streets of Rage 4. So this is just Lizard Cube. And this is part of the kind of Sega reboot. You know, they're doing like 6 classic Sega titles that they're remaking. And I think this is the first we've seen a release date for and like trailer for, etc. And I think... Because it's Crazy Taxi that they're like saying it's going to be a big open world, like massive game. Whereas this is like a digital only 2D, you know, doesn't look like it's a Metroidvania game or anything like that. It's classic Ninja Gaiden, probably going to be like 10 levels, you know, take a couple of hours to complete. But I think that's the right thing to do with this game and the right thing to do with this franchise. It's a lot quicker than that original kind of like arcade or Mega Drive versions. It's very, very fast. Lots of kind of attacks, lots of different, you know, moves in there and different magics and stuff like that. But I think this looks really, really cool. And I was thinking about it because I grew up with Shinobi, and it's not one of those games where I'm like, oh, I love Shinobi. Like, I love Streets of Rage. Mm. And I was like, you know what? I do really enjoy the Shinobi games. I just think it was always, they were just a bit hard. So maybe yes. I didn't have as much love for them as a kid.
I remember pumping loads of money into them. Well, you know, loads of money, like 50p.
Yeah.
in the arcade back in the day. But yeah, I never lasted very long in there. And it's like the style of it. It was definitely one of those games where you'd think, oh, just one more go. I'll do it this time. Yeah, definitely had that kind of appeal to it. And I think, yeah, when you mentioned then this is faster and probably harder than the original. I look at that and think, oh, God, I've got no chance in this.
Yeah, it might be harder, but, you know, I'm sure there'll be a safe function in there. Yeah. And you know.
Like, this is a prime example of one of those titles coming out where the younger generations would be like, what? Okay, and then go back and look at the older titles as well.
So it is nice to see that, you know, we've mentioned before Sega showing some love to their forgotten back catalogue. I think, you know, when was the last Shinobi game we got? I think early 2010s?
There was a DS one.
Yeah, and 2011 3D one, wasn't there? Yeah,
there was one on the DS, which I've heard is quite good. And then obviously there was a couple on the PS2, which were the 3D ones.
Yeah, which I can never get into those.
Yeah, I've heard they're good, but I just, once again, I had a friend who had them and played them at his house, and it was just a little bit like, this isn't Shinobi.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I agree. I booted it up on my PS2 for about 10, 15 minutes and I was the same. I was like, yeah, cool game, but it doesn't feel like a Shinobi game.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, going back to roots and having a classic 2D style, especially from this team who obviously did so well with Streets of Rage 4.
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely in good hands. And there is going to be a physical edition of it as well.
Oh,
apparently.
Is there? Oh, okay.
Brilliant. Yeah. So if you want to keep it old school, there's going to be... physical for the Switch and the PlayStation 5.
You were right as well. I've just given it a quick look. Shinobi 3D was 2011 for Nintendo DS.
Yeah, so nice to see it getting some love, you know, over a decade later. And like I said, going back to roots. So if you want to get hold of that, it's coming out on all the modern platforms on the 29th of August this year. So we're one for your summer holidays. So we'll keep an eye on that and let you know as we hear more. Right then, patrons, stand by. A few extra news stories on the way for you in just a moment. Because we chopped the adverts out of the patrons' version of the podcast. So rather than giving you a shorter show, we'll give you a few extra news stories every single week. That's on the way. For everybody else, our special guest, Kelly Sumner, on the way. Part one of that epic interview talking about his time at Commodore coming up in just a moment. First, though, let's give a huge thank you to this week's sponsor. And it is, of course, our wonderful friends with the sound that we love hearing. The sound of making money is our mates at Shopify. Now, actually, at the weekend, my missus was setting up a little storefront on Shopify on Sunday afternoon.
Oh, nice. Did you see how easy it was to do?
Well, that's the thing, because, I mean, you guys know my missus, and, her and technology don't always gel all that well, I think it's fair to say. But she just does, like, crafts and stuff, so she was doing some, like, embroidery. Upcycling old clothes and stuff and some patterns. And she thought, you know, she wanted to sell them online. So I said, well, you know, I might be able to help you out with that. Used our little exclusive link, which is...
excellent, yeah.
So we've got a sale. Shopify.co.uk/retrohour, of course, helps out the podcast. And the thing is, my missus uses like stuff like Canva. She can design things on there and everything. Or drag and drop, point and click. And she actually found it really easy to set up a store on Shopify.
And I guess she can also, publish across all the channels there.
Yeah.
Social media, pump out and, you know, get some customers there.
Yeah, she's got like a Facebook page, Instagram, connects to all those, can basically do your marketing for you. And the great thing about it is, like I said, you know, my missus, not technically minded, but everything on this, drag and drop, should no problem send.
And also, you know, the sales, customising the sales and having that kind of storefront and shop, it's really important just to kind of get all the shipping estimates and stuff like that.
It works it all out for you, doesn't it? Which is massive time saver. And also she does a lot of like the like craft events and stuff over the summer, craft fairs and that kind of thing. So Shopify also do those in-person point of sale systems.
Yes.
So you can take card payments when you're in person as well.
Load up your whole inventory in there.
Yeah, so it keeps it all synced as well with your e-commerce platform as well. So basically Shopify, if you've got a bit of a side hustle going on, or maybe you're even thinking of becoming your own boss this year as well, they are revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. It is the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth every step of the way and give you complete control over it. Like I said, no new skills, no design, no coding, nothing like that needed. And if you ever need it, they've also got award-winning help and a huge extensive business course library on there as well. So it's time to get serious about selling. Why don't you give Shopify a try today? Now, of course, we've got you that amazing offer. You can have that as well if you want to try out Shopify for just £1 a month on a trial period. Head to our link. They'll know that we sent you. Helps out the podcast. Shopify.co.uk/retrohour, all lowercase. Shopify.co.uk/retrohour. And get ready to take your business to the next level today and hear a lot more of this. Right, well, thank you for checking out the news on this week's podcast. We'll have more for you on next Friday's show. Hopefully we'll see you on the Patrons Hangout this Sunday, theretrohour.com. A little reminder as well, I was checking Apple Podcasts the other day. I don't think we've had an Apple Podcast review since June of last year, which, you know, don't want to say people are slacking or anything, but...
You're slacking.
It does really help, if you put a podcast review, because it gets in front of new faces.
Basically Apple Podcast looks at that and thinks, oh, people are interested in the show. helps us get up the charts in front of new people as well. So obviously we appreciate, not everyone can join us on Patreon, but you know, if you would like another little way, little 5-second job that'll really help us out, a little 5-star rating, nice little comment on your podcast client of choice, always hugely appreciated. Right then, next, the first of an epic 2-parter, this time going inside the world of Commodore and the Amiga in the UK with former managing director Kelly Sumner. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guest. Now, today, someone who we've been really excited to talk to because he was a big part of our childhoods growing up. You know that Ravi and I, huge fans of the Amiga, so we're definitely going to spend quite a bit of time getting some memories from Commodore and the Amiga as well. But also our guest this week, we have some huge companies, Take-Two Interactive, Game Tech, CEO of Red Octane, of course, behind Guitar Hero, chairman of Mediatonic, lots more as well. But we're going to start with his role at Commodore UK now. He started there as a trainee electronics engineer, worked through sales and support, marketing manager, retail product sales director, and eventually became managing director. So I'm sure we've got some juicy stories to hear over the next hour or two, Kelly. This is Kelly Sumner. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Yeah, I'm hopeful I can give you some decent stories. Let's see.
Well, I mean, you've got a lot to cover. I mean, wow, what a career so far. But let's kind of, you know, go way back to the start then, back to day one. I mean, How did you initially get into electronics then? Where did your interest begin?
It didn't. Right. So I left home at 16. I'm dyslexic, dysfunctional family. So I didn't have to, but I chose to leave home. And so I needed to earn money. And I walked past Slough Job Centre one day, and there was an advert for trainee electronics engineers, training given. I thought, I don't know what electronics are. In 1979, not many people did. I thought, I'm going to go for it. There's training involved. So I applied for the job, but I was obviously not qualified in any shape, form, or manner. But what I did find out is that this company called Commodore were moving down from Eaglescliff in the northeast down to Slough, and they were hiring 29 people. So I basically did a Yosser. For the people who are old enough to remember that voice from the Black Stuff. And I kept on ringing this guy. I said, give me a job, give me a job, give me a job, give me a job. In the end, he got so fed up with me, he gave me the job. And I happened to be the first person at 818 Lee Road, which is where Commodore started in Slough. And my first job, it was a massive warehouse with nothing in apart from me and a broom. And that was my first day at Commodore.
Well, when you joined, what were you working on then? Like, what were your first kind of tasks and
products? Oh, okay, yeah.
Apart from sweeping up.
Apart from sweeping up. Yeah, that didn't take me too long, quite frankly. So I was in the calculator area. So I was repairing calculators. And we had a huge range of calculators. And this is all before even the PET. So we had calculators, watches, we did a chess product called Chess, I think it was called Chessmate. So that's where I spent my first 2 years at Commodore repairing calculators. It was interesting.
Well, when the VIC-20 came along, obviously the first million-selling home computer.
Yeah.
Then we had the Commodore 64 as well. I mean, I did read that you were the sole engineer on the VIC-20 and C64 in the UK at the time. What memories have you got of that?
I don't know where you read that, but it's true, actually.
Wow.
I mean, why they allowed me to fiddle around with such kind of complicated electronics as it was in the day. But yes, I was the first engineer on the VIC-20s and the 64, and I was followed by a great friend of mine called Douglas Cordwell, who actually I lost touch with for about 20 years, and I recently made contact with him and going on holiday in Scotland with him later on in the year. So, it was, to be fair, the diagnostic equipment that Commodore provided was really, really helpful, and it pretty much got you to kind of repair about 95% of the computer. So I didn't need really need. I just needed a steady hand with a soldering iron, and I was away.
With the kind of success of the 64 as well, were you getting a lot more demand coming through? You know, it was, I think, the biggest selling computer in the world at one time.
Well, yeah, it was really interesting, actually, because I can remember it must have, it was, I'm not sure, it was after the launch of the VIC-20, I think, just before the launch of the 64. And the company was doing incredibly well. And what they decided was to give us a bonus scheme for the whole company, the worldwide. And basically what they did is they allocated us an amount of shares, and they said, whatever the growth of those shares in the year, we will pay out as a bonus. And the shares, I can't believe this, the shares went up like 110% in the year. It was bonkers. But funnily enough, they didn't want to pay us 110% of our wages. So what they did do is actually they did pay the majority of it, but they paid us kind of installments, like 27%, 25% until we got the majority of it. But it was incredibly generous, and it was a massively exciting time. It really, really was.
Do you remember when you first saw the Amiga, and what were your initial impressions of that machine, the Amiga 1000?
Yes, I do. It was, oh my God, this is absolutely incredible. And we didn't really know what we were going to do with it. Because it fitted, you know, it can be used in the music industry, obviously the games industry. It was used for subtitling. It had so many opportunities. And I think that was one of our issues. We didn't focus on anything particularly. We tried to put our arms around everything. But luckily, obviously, that was followed up by the 500, I guess it was. And so we obviously added straight into the games market. But it was, I can remember the bouncing ball and Tutankhamun's face and using deluxe paint. It was such a dream. And people's kind of jaws, when we went to shows, people's jaws dropped. They just couldn't believe what they were seeing and hearing. Obviously had great sound as well. It was really, really cool time.
How important were Electronic Arts as well, you know, when they declared that they were using the Amiga and then also got the products like Deep Paint out there and the creative kind of titles?
Yeah, I think we were, I mean, to be fair, I think we were both really helpful for each other. I mean, don't forget, Electronic Arts were a fairly small company in those days. But Deluxe Paint, that alone convinced people to buy the Amiga, because they just couldn't believe some of the stuff that you could produce so easily with Deluxe Paint. And that's obviously the reason we bundled it, because, you know, it could be seen also as educational. I guess it possibly was in some cases. But it was just jaw-dropping what you could do with it compared with, you know, coming away from the Commodore. I mean, the jump from a 64 to Amiga, I mean, I don't know how you can compare it, probably like the Tiger Moth to a Learjet or something like that.
Yeah.
It was mind-blowing, absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, I've heard people say it felt like a computer from the future when they saw it in 1985.
Yeah, we got really, really lucky because it was destined to go to Atari, is my understanding at the time.
Well, you found a place on the Amiga sales team. So what was it like selling the Amiga 1000 in the UK? And kind of who was the main customer? I mean, who was buying the A1000 at that stage in the UK?
Well, I think the majority of people were developers and trying to see an opportunity. I mean, as I said, you know, it was being used in TV and sound, et cetera, but I remember that because I actually had to go and knock on people's doors who actually had bought them and to find out what the hell they were doing, because we were trying to find out what the hell we should be doing But so we're trying to find out what they were doing, if they can give us a hint to the, where we should be directing our efforts. And I can remember, I don't know if you remember a guy called Jez San, Argonaut Software. Yeah. Well, I mean, Jez has done incredibly well. I mean, stupid.
We had him recently on the podcast. Yeah.
Oh, right. Lovely guy. He's now doing, I think he's messing around with DJing and stuff like that. But anyway, I actually spoke to him about a year ago. But I remember going to see this guy. I mean, I don't know. I just got a name and an address. Obviously, I didn't think I had a telephone number or anything. Anyway, no mobile phones weren't even invented in those days. It was North London. I was driving through this really nice suburb, and I couldn't understand. You know, I was expecting a kind of small industrial estate or something like that. And I found the house. I knocked on it, and I think Jez must have been 15 or something like that. And we went up to his bedroom, and it showed me what he was doing with the Amiga. And obviously, he did very, very well out of it. But yeah, it was it literally, we had. If anyone tells you anything different, they're lying. We had no idea. We knew it was amazing, but it was like, okay, it's fantastic, but what the hell do we do it? What vertical do we address? We just didn't know. But obviously the price came down, 500 came out, and it was clear where we were going to go.
I was going to say, you know, the 500 was launched, and also the 2000, and that was in 1987, and you kind of had the two lines started then, when you had the gaming kind of line and then the business line. What were the difference of approaches with sales of those?
Well, we sold a lot and they didn't. I was in the consumer. Yes. I was in the consumer division, which was the A500. And we were still selling 64s in those days as well, in good numbers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know what the figures were, but we probably sold, you know, 20,000 to every one of their one. And they were trying to carve out a market. But the management in the US had this idea that we were a business systems, because it's Commodore business machines. And they still had this idea that we were going to, you know, beat IBM or beat Compaq or beat whoever. And so they were desperate to do something serious with the A2000, etc. But it was really, really hard work. And when you're making so much money and selling, I mean, it was, you know, you weren't taking orders for hundreds. We were taking orders for thousands, tens of thousands. I mean, I remember Dixon's one year. I think their first order was like 50,000 units. It was just crazy. Absolutely crazy. So, we carried on with that business area for some considerable time, but it wasn't really focused. But ultimately, that was probably the downfall of the company, thinking that they were a serious computer company. We were serious, but serious in home computing and gaming. If we focused on that rather than using resources trying to be in the next IBM, then we probably will be around today, I think.
I wondered about, in the UK, we had the schools deal going on with the BBC Micro and Acorns. Was there ever like a Commodore attempt to get in that area, or was it kind of completely dominated by those guys?
Yeah, no, we did. I mean, we did try, but it was never. I mean, they didn't want an American company. They just they clearly wanted to do their own thing. So it was always going to be between Clive Sinclair or Acorn. There was never any chance for us to get in there. I mean, we also did try and buy ICL at one stage, which was probably a good thing that we didn't. But we did try, you know, that would have given us lots of contracts as well, government contracts. But that wasn't so very successful either.
When the Amiga 500 was, you know, aimed at that home market, and obviously kids were asking the parents for the A500 for games mainly, even though obviously, like you said, Commodore wanted to put a few educational products in there as well, probably to help that sale. I mean, did you see like Sega and Nintendo as competitors at that stage?
No. And they really weren't, to be fair. I mean, obviously big in Japan. And I mean, what we did is we really screwed the US market and gave them an opportunity to come into that market, because it's a long time ago, but I do remember that we took the 64 and we had a fantastic dealer base worldwide, but also clearly in America. And we gave the product effectively exclusively to Walmart, who absolutely screwed the arse out of the price, and all our dealers disappeared, which gave an opportunity for other people to backfill and take our dealer base. But we didn't think they were going to be as serious contenders as they were, but we had the technology to be able to actually fend them off. But I keep on saying this, but we were in Europe, we knew what we were, and we were very focused on it, and we were very, very successful, whether it be Germany or Italy or France or the UK, very successful. But we were an American company, and we had to, you know, dance to their tune. And they were still convinced up until almost we went bankrupt. I obviously left them before we went bankrupt, but up until a year or two before we went bankrupt, that we were going to be a serious business machine. We're going to compete with Apple. And in fact, I mean, you know, if you go back to the early days of Commodore, we owned Moss Technology, and which was the 6502, which was in the first Apples, for Christ's sakes. You know, I mean, we did have the market by the short and curlies if we'd made the right moves, but we just kept on making the wrong moves in America and losing huge amounts of money, which we could never compensate for in Europe.
Well, in 1989, Commodore UK launched, and this was a region-specific thing, I believe, a consoleized version of the C64 without a keyboard. It didn't have a cassette player. It was called the Commodore 64 Game System, which sold for £99. I did hear that you were quite heavily involved in this. I mean, what was kind of the thinking behind that, and what was the idea from your perspective, and how did that turn out?
It didn't turn out very well, did it? can we just concentrate on the stuff that I was good at, Rob? Yeah, well, the idea was that obviously at that stage we knew that Sega and Nintendo were a threat. And so it was our kind of nod to make a cartridge-based product to compete with them. But to be fair, we just couldn't get traction with the development community. They just... You know, they were really happy making money out of the Amiga. Some of them were already started on the Sega and Nintendo route, etc. And bringing another format in. And also cartridges were expensive, yada, yada, yada. It just never took off. Never took off. A lot of time and effort, but no reward.
Well, those Amiga packs were kind of legendary as well. They sold with many different titles, and you also had applications in there as well. And I remember there were some C64 packs back in the days as well. But what were your kind of memories of the like cartoon classics and a Batman pack and Screen Gems, I think was another one.
Yeah, that's of the 90s.
Yeah. Well, that was really fun because it allowed us to be creative with a bit of plastic and a bit of silicon. It was all about the marketing, really and truthfully. We tried to pick the games that we thought were going to be huge, like The Simpsons or Batman and Ghostbusters and et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes we got it right, sometimes we didn't. But it did allow us to re-image pretty much every year. And that really worked, as I say, really worked from a marketing perspective. And I think it elongated the shelf life of the Amiga by some time, actually.
Yeah, when we had David Pleasance on, he said, instead of selling, like you said, the slab of plastic, it was selling dreams, not computers.
Yeah. David would tell you, it didn't come, you know, there was an awful lot of time and effort research into trying to find out not only what was going to be cool or what was going to be big. Whether I mean, we did get our Days of Thunder. I remember we had in a pack. It was supposed to be was it Tom Cruise? Maybe Tom Cruise. I don't know. Anyway, it was supposed to be the big game of the year, and the film absolutely tanked, and it wasn't a very big game. But we did get it right more times than we got it wrong. And also, it wasn't just about getting the right, you know, signing a deal with Ocean for The Simpsons or whatever. It's actually making sure that game was delivered on time, without bugs. I mean, that was just tortuous. I mean, I remember Ocean said to us, and I'm sure it's absolute load of old codswallop, that they went back to Matt Groening, over 6 or 7 weeks, because on the entry on the loader screen there was a large picture of Bart and he was winking or he was doing something, and Matt Groening kept on pushing it back. Probably he didn't. I think it was just Ocean. They were just
buying time.
But thankfully it did come out in time. Can you imagine? We've done all the artwork. We've done the all the campaigns are ready to go. You know, we've done all the presentations to all the major retailers. Everyone's going, yeah. And then we haven't got something. In fact, I think I don't think it was an Amiga. I think it was on the 64. There was at least one occasion we had to replace something because it didn't turn up on time. But the 64 packs weren't clearly as big as the Amiga packs as far as sales are concerned.
This is a random question as well. There were a lot of like office packages on other platforms as well, and they were very recognizable, like Microsoft Office, of course.
Word Perfect.
Lotus 1-2-3.
Yeah. I was wondering, was there a bit of a kind of struggle getting the Office packages like prominent and forward for the Amiga? Because I had some good stuff like Final Writer and Final
Cut. Or Mavis Beacon, Type and Tutor, I remember.
And
Mavis Beacon was just a made up person. Surprise. I think she was a secretary in Chicago, allegedly.
Oh, anyways, on the box. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I've read that story.
It was really, I mean, we did actually in the early days of the thousands, et cetera, we really pushed with people like Lotus to get packages on there. Because don't forget, you know, we at one stage, we kind of owned the small business market with the PET. And VisiCalc and all, don't ask me too many questions, because that was even further back. But we did own the business market. And so we thought that maybe the Amiga 1000 was going to be the new pet of the day. But clearly it wasn't. I also remember in the early days of Commodore, there was like a 9-month waiting list to get a pet. It was just ridiculous. And the first 4000 and... I guess it's 4032. So it was a 40 column, 32K memory. First one that ever came into the country, someone stole from the warehouse. Oh, we all had our fingerprints taken. I mean, it was really serious stuff. Anyway, sorry, I'm going off on tangents.
No, that's really interesting to hear. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that waiting list there. I mean, there was another product that came along in 1990 that I remember being really hyped at the time. Unfortunately, didn't go on to do very well. I think maybe a bit ahead of its time. And that was the Commodore CD TV. Now, that was on the market, I think, a bit before Philips had a competitive system called the CDI. I think the CD TV beat it to market a bit. But I remember Commodore viewed CD technology as really important. What are your memories of the CD TV then? And what was that like to put together and sell?
I remember doing a tour, at least going to New York and doing a press thing with Nolan Bushnell. I'm sure it's CD32. So, you know, Nolan Bushnell is kind of a god of our industry for people who don't know him, should look him up. Very, very interesting man. Chuck E. Cheese was probably a bit of a tangent in his business career, but I used to go to Chuck E. Cheese when I lived in America. I think it was really an interesting concept. But again, we just couldn't get the kind of support that we needed from the software community. And we did obviously sell some, but again, minor, because it was like, what really is it?
We apparently read that like Comet and Dixon's like had them separately. Kind of displayed, so away from the Amigas, and they were more in the kind of entertainment area.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it didn't, because it didn't really fall, you know, when you take it to a retailer and the planogram people, blah, 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 they couldn't understand where it should sit. And it was expensive as well. I mean, it was like £1,000 or something like that. That was a lot of money in those days. So you'd probably have to be a very lucky young lad or lady to get one of those.
Yeah, but I don't think that market ever came to fruition, did it? Because I remember they were banking on people reading encyclopedias in the living room and looking at world atlases multimedia.
Multimedia was going to be the savior of CD TV. But yeah, I mean, some kind of interesting things came out, but there was no killer apps. There was nothing that was like, I've got to buy this. Whereas, you know, going back to the Amiga or even the Commodore 64, that when you showed that for the very first time, the 64, based against what it was competing with, the Sinclair or the VIC 20, people went, oh my, wow, that's really cool. Because, you know, some of the demos were really, really, really nice. And of course, it was, you said, the Amiga 500, they looked at it and went, wow, CD32 is like a lot of money, bulky.
Yeah. And I guess, yeah, if your biggest selling point is like a world atlas or something for £1,000 computer, it's, yeah, I've got one of those already. It's a hard sell.
and also, you've got to think that from the company's perspective, you know, I can go out there, I'm not sure what job I had at that time, but I could go down Tottenham Court Road and get a container load of orders for Amiga 500, or I could try and sell 20 CDTVs, and it was a lot easier to get a 40-foot container into Goldtronics at Tottenham Court Road than it was 10 CDTVs, believe me.
Yeah. Well, in the summer of 1992, you took over as managing director of Commodore UK. So what was the story with you getting that role? Because I think you were like, 31 years old? You were really young to take over as MD of a big company. And how did you get the job? And how did you take over from Steve Franklin? What was kind of the story there?
So the short answer is I was really good at my job. But the real answer, there were issues between Steve and Mehdi Ali. Mehdi Ali was a really difficult person to work for. And I'm not privy, although I was really close to Steve, and you know, I went to his I didn't actually go to the funeral, but I went to the celebration of his life and stuff like that. There was just some stuff that was floating around that I'm pretty sure was absolutely untrue, but Mehdi decided to believe it. And someone rang me up and said, he used to call me by your surname. It was never Kelly. Sumner. Get on a plane to New York tomorrow. Go to the Waldorf or whatever, and stay there until I ring you. Oh, wow. Okay. I mean, and don't tell anyone. So I did. I was duly summoned and I didn't know what was going on. I had no idea. I was sales director at the time. So I was in the first line report to Steve, as was the CFO, et cetera, et cetera. And he just said, right, Sumner, I want you to take over, blah, blah, blah. And away you go. And it was, I think Mehdi saw me as a kind of protege. And he really liked me for some unknown reason. But also, you know, to be fair, I had been really, really successful, we were a sales stroke marketing led company, but certainly sales. And if you were knocking the, you know, we were, you know, killing the figures every quarter, every year, and obviously not all down to me, but I'm down to the team. And he thought, hey, give this guy a go, because I've got an issue with Steve, and I'm going to see if he works out.
I was wondering, when you became MD, what the communication was like between all the different Commodore branches, and were people working separately, you know, the UK subsidiary versus Germany, or versus, you look at Sega with Nintendo in America, there was a big difference going on there?
No, we actually, we worked pretty well together, you know, with Italy and France and Germany. Obviously, you know, Germans, because they had a manufacturing plant there, they see, and because our kind of a European head office was in Frankfurt, they saw themselves as the kingpins, and, you know, they did incredibly well. But we got on really, really well. But I Mehdi was an absolute nightmare. And he used to call, we used to have to troop off to Frankfurt, you know, X number of times a month and sit around the table and listen to him tell us what we're doing wrong all the time. And I remember we used to have these dealer incentives. So we used to take dealers away to Hong Kong, China, to Sri Lanka, Kenya, etc. So you had to sell a certain number of points via the distributors for selling or buying Commodore equipment. And if you got enough points, you and maybe your spouse or maybe a couple of people, depending on how successful you are, got taken over to these trips. And I was in, we were in the Seychelles. And he rang me up and said, "Sumner, I want you in Frankfurt on Friday." And I said, "Mehdi, I can't do that. We've got 100 dealers and it's the gala night on Friday and I'm the host. I can't do that." He said, "You arrange it. You've got to be there. No question." And I said, "I can't get a flight." Anyway, he took hours and hours and hours. I think he personally actually, and he found a flight via Charles de Gaulle. We changed the hotel. Were very, you know, accommodating. We changed everything with the hotel. Had the gala dinner early. I whizzed off to Frankfurt, and literally I had nothing with me because the next day they're all coming back, and I was going to go back from Frankfurt to London, so I didn't have anything with me. And I got to Charles de Gaulle, and I knew there was an early, a slightly earlier flight, so I ran to the gate, and the guys from France, Commodore France, were in the queue, but they closed it, and I couldn't get onto the earlier flight. So I said, "Don't worry, guys, I'll see you in an hour." And the French air traffic controllers went on strike.
Oh, God. Oh,
I'm God. Sitting there with nothing. I mean, no money, nothing. Yeah, I probably had a credit card, of course. But and it's like, oh, man, I'm going to miss the meeting. It was really important. Oh, my God. Anyway, they were only on strike for about 3 hours. So I caught a flight, got to Frankfurt, rushed into this huge room with this massive table with all the guys sitting around. I said, "Right, I'm sorry, Mehdi. You know, this is what happened." He said, "Oh, don't worry. We covered it."
What the? It's traveled halfway around the world.
Yeah. "Don't worry, we covered it, Sumner. It's okay, man." I went, okay. Oh, wow. So the next year, I'm in Barbados. Sounds like a wonderful job, actually, Mike. We're in Barbados. And I get into the hotel room, and there's a message, phone the New York office. So I phone New York office, and his assistant said, "Mehdi says you need to be in New York in 3 days' time." And I went, no. I'm speaking to him. So I spoke to him. I said, "I need to be, I'm in Barbados." He said, "Oh, don't worry. Next week could do."
Right.
But he was a nightmare. We used to have this planning meeting. What he called a planning meeting is it was basically he beat the hell out of you at every opportunity. And so I remember sitting in the Maidenhead office at the switchback, and we'd go through all the products. So, you know, all the 64 product, 1541, then the Amiga product. And he'd basically try and talk you up as much as he can. And he'd say, he'd maybe get like 10,000 more Amigas that I committed to. And he'd pick the phone up. And I'd ring the guy in Hong Kong and said, "Sumner says he wants another 10,500s. Puts the phone down. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning. "Oh, Sumner says he wants some more, you know, monitors." And this guy probably got no sleep because Mehdi just kept ringing up. So he could have left it all to the end, but no, that wasn't his style at all.
this guy's wife going, turn the phone off.
Don't work for this idiot. He's a nightmare. Yeah.
That's incredible. Before the days of Zoom, it could have been very different.
Yeah, remote working.
Yes, yeah. It would have probably saved probably guy's age before his time, but yeah.
Well, one of our first introductions to you as a manager of Commodore UK was, I don't know if you remember this, an appearance on the TV show Games Master, where you went on there to play the video game Humans, and that clip is available on YouTube. I'll just put it out there. I mean, have you got any memories of doing that?
Oh, yes.
What was the thinking behind it?
Oh yes, that was I was basically the marketing department decided that it was a really good idea, and I'm a crap gamer, to be absolutely frank. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you're going to make that. Humans was actually developed by Game Tech, and I joined Game Tech after Commodore, but that was just so the basically you had to go on there and they gave you a level of a game and you had to finish it in a certain time, and it was the first level of Humans. So obviously I played it like crazy every day that week before I went down to Sunbury on Thames. It was in the Waterworks there, an old building there, and Dominic Diamond was the host. I remember I had a fairly trendy suit on at the time.
You're the only person on Games Master I ever saw with a suit on, actually. Never saw anyone else wearing a suit on that show.
Anyway, and I had hair, which was very interesting. So I remember playing the game, and I finished it, and Dominic Diamond said, oh, and he didn't make it. And I went, luckily it was obviously recorded like this. I said, what do you mean you didn't make it? I did make it. I absolutely made it just on time. And he said, oh, no, I don't think so. I said, well, let's ask the crowd. And there was a crowd kind of on a gantry above us. And so I appealed to the crowd and they went, yeah, he made it. So they had to shoot the... shoot a different ending.
Oh wow.
Yeah. In fact, I was in my local co-op in my village in Somerset last week, and this guy behind the counter said, I remember you with hair. I was like, what are you talking about? I've only known you like a year. What do you mean you know the hair? He said, yeah, you're Games Master. I went, oh god, yeah. And we got a golden joystick, which was basically a gas joystick painted gold.
Yeah, I think it was like a Cheetah 125 spray painted, wasn't it? It wasn't actually made of gold.
I was trying to think. I think you're right. It was. Yeah, with a red button. Yeah, I remember. But that's been my wife's probably put it in the bin at some stage, and rightly so.
Well, it was interesting, your relationship with Amiga magazines as well, because they were really huge at the time. We've still actually got an Amiga magazine in shops, which is crazy. But CU Amiga talked about the kind of shock as you entertain them at the Commodore HQ. Did you want to like be a bit more open as a leader than Commodore usually were?
I basically tried to speak as openly and as I can. And at the end of the day, it is only a job.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, I don't want people to think that I've kind of led them down the garden path or got them to commit their precious resources, whether it be a magazine or whatever they are, on something that is absolute BS. I was very open about what we did, why we were doing it, and how we were doing it. And those guys, the Amiga magazines were massively, obviously, particularly, the guys in Bath.
Amiga Format.
Future, particularly Future.
We obviously shared the Commodore show became a future show at the end, I think it was.
Yeah, Future Entertainment, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they were massively important to us because, you know, we didn't have the internet, and if people wanted to know what the latest, the greatest, the best, they bought the magazine, and they were massively subscribed to. It was they were very, very helpful, and without the support of the magazines and obviously the developers, but you know, we went out there, you know, and I think a lot of it was started by Steve, quite frankly. he was a kind of breath of fresh air. In fact, the day he joined the company, I resigned. I was resigned before he joined. This sounds fickle. I had a job at Compaq, a regional sales manager job at Compaq, and you used to be able to drive a 325, I think it was, and the wages were better. I've had enough of the previous MD, who I won't name. And so I resigned. And this guy called Tom Hart, who was a senior manager at Commodore at the time, got hold of Steve and said, "You don't want to lose this guy. You know, you need to keep this guy." And so Steve came in at 8 o'clock in the morning and said, come and meet me at 8 o'clock in the morning. And he was a fantastic salesman. I mean, he was a lovely, lovely, lovely guy. I mean, I have some fantastic times with that man. And he persuaded me to stay with the company because he was going to do this and he was going to do that and I'm going to do this and this is how you're going to. And I was like, wow, yeah, yeah. And then he proceeded to bring his whole team in from Granada Business Systems. And it's like, oh. So eventually I saw most of them off and things worked out really, really well. But the point I'm getting is Steve was a very open guy, very charismatic, and that kind of worked the way through a lot of the through to us. So we were open and engaging with the developers and the publishers, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas I guess a lot of hardware manufacturers aren't. Because they see themselves elevated above those people.
Well, I do remember that summer, 1992. You did have a pretty tough job in the press because you had to justify. And I do remember seeing quotes from you and pictures of you alongside these stories. Commodore's decision to kill off the best-selling Amiga 500 and sell the idea of the replacement machine, the A600, which didn't seem all that popular with the readers of the magazine. So what memories have you got of that? And what did you think of the Amiga 600?
It was cheaper. That's it. That was the drive. It was basically, you know, pretty much the same. It was a same kind of deal, but it was the manufacturing costs were significantly cheaper. And when you were, yeah, selling hundreds of thousands and millions of computers, you know, an extra $5, $10 here made a big difference. Yeah, it was almost like losing a beautiful child with the Amiga 500, because that was, you know, the saving grace really of Commodore. We, you know, the 64 was good, but it was a bit getting a bit long in the tooth, etc. And we had competitors like, I don't know, Amstrad and coming along, and obviously the Nintendo and Sega. So the Amiga was really, really important, but we just couldn't carry on manufacturing it at the cost that it had. So we had to have a smaller form factor, etc. And it was engineered to be significantly cheaper. And at the end of the day, that's what we were trying to do: drive the cost down as low as possible, so we could sell as many as possible.
I do remember it was quite unfortunate timing because they released the long-awaited CD-ROM drive for the Amiga 500, the A570, just as the machine was discontinued, which always seemed a bit weird, because I remember walking into Dixon's, seeing the Amiga 600 and the A570 CD-ROM drive, and there's a sign, not compatible with each other, on top of it.
Yeah. I don't know if you've got a very good memory or you've just done a lot of research, but yeah.
Bit of both.
Yeah, we didn't sell many of them, put it that way.
Well, what were your kind of memories of the 1200 as well? And was there a bit of a recovery with that? And, you know, AGA as well coming out?
Yeah. I mean, that was a kind of, it then become a serious, not a serious, but a serious games machine. It was never going to be serious, but it would have been the better to replace the 500 with the 1200. But 1200 was more expensive, etc., etc. So, but yeah, that was a pleasure, because it just seemed like the Amiga 600, it was just cheapening such a wonderful technology, really. But we had to do it. I mean, we had no choice. We couldn't tell Medi we couldn't sell them, and we would have lost our jobs.
Well, even though the Amiga 1200 was selling really well that Christmas 1992, there were stories around the time of huge financial losses at Commodore every quarter. I mean, when did you realize that the company was in trouble, and what do you think caused it?
Well, I know what caused it. I mentioned it a couple of times earlier on. I mean, it's our inability to understand exactly who we were in America. When did I leave? I can't even remember when I left.
In 93.
That's 93, it. So I remember the Christmas of 92. You can probably tell me I'm a liar by looking at company's house, but I think we made like 23 million. We had an absolutely fantastic Christmas, amazing Christmas. We came out with, you know, very little inventory in the trade, etc. It was nice and clean. Everyone was happy. We weren't a very big team. I think, you know, maybe 50 people. I don't know. Maybe not even that at that stage. And it was an incredible performance. And I remember Mehdi coming over, and he always used to say it wasn't the Ritz, but it was just one of those kind of type of hotels. And he used to have a chauffeur-driven car, and he used to have the car parked outside the door, wait for him all day long. I mean, money didn't seem to be much of a problem. And he came in and he said to me, Simon, I said, you got to cut some heads. And I went, what? He said, yeah, we've got to cut some heads, Sumner. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And I believe that quarter, the corporation lost about 80 million, something like that. Yeah. But we in the UK and a number of other subsidiaries, I'm sure Germany and Italy, made money. But we were being punished for what was happening in America. And what was happening in America, they were bringing in really expensive people from IBM or whatever, paying them millions and millions, trying to break into. I mean, you know, I've lived there twice. It's, you know, it's a big country, you know, and you can spend a lot of money very, very, very quickly. And they had no real direction. And that's when I decided, that's it. I said, in fact, I went home to my wife and I said, we've got two choices here. I said, I can stick it out, but I don't think they're going to survive, or I should leave. She said, leave. But before that, to give you an idea, the chipset of the Amiga was stellar. And I remember being in one of those Frankfurt meetings, and I can't remember, Helmut something or other, and Vertimambelli in Italy and whoever it was in France, we'd been discussing, you know, what we could do, et cetera, et cetera. And we thought it was a really good idea to do a graphics card for the PC using the Amiga chipset. Mm. It wouldn't have been very difficult, and it would have been incredible. You know, it would have opened new opportunities for us. And I remember we sat there and basically told Mehdi, this is a really good idea. It's going to be really good for us. I mean, Germany particularly had a massive PC market, which we didn't have. They were number one PC supplier for years into the market. And he basically said it was horseshit, and it went no further. And so the whole drain of resource in America was basically crippling it. Europe just couldn't, you know, kind of look after themselves and look after the crippled American company, and it was inevitable. And to be fair, when we lost Jack, we lost a massive, not just a figurehead. I mean, the guy was, I tell you what, he was lovely. Well, he wasn't always lovely, but he was always, every time I met him, and I didn't meet him many times, but I remember when I was in the service department. And he came in, I walked down, and I said, can I have a word? And he said, what's the problem? I said, we've got a problem with these 1541 disk drives. I said, you know, they're losing alignment. We ship them out and they come back. We have to realign them. And he said, okay. And he said, and he got the whole lot shipped back to the manufacturer and said, right, you know, sort it out because this is, but so, you know, he listened to people, but he was also, he was a visionary. There's no question he was a visionary. And when we lost Jack, we lost the kind of beating heart of the company. And Apple done quite well. But there was no one there to replace him. There was no visionary. There was no, and you know, Mehdi was, the reason Mehdi got a job is because he helped refinance. He's a financier. He refinanced the company. And because that, Irving Gould gave him a job to run the company, and greatest respect to the guy, He just didn't have the skill set. He had no understanding of our markets, and so it's basically when Jack left, it was just a question of when.
Yeah.
If Jack Tramiel had still been there and he hadn't been forced out because he wanted his sons on the board and yada yada, all that kind of stuff, if he had still been there, this would be they'd still be around. There'd be a multi-billion dollar company. There's no question about that.
So I hope you enjoyed part one of our interview with Kelly Sumner. Next week on the show, we hear more stories from his post-Commodore career at Game Tech and Take-Two Interactive, bringing huge titles to the market like Grand Theft Auto 3, his move to Red Octane, and the smash that was Guitar Hero. All of that coming up on next Friday's podcast. If you can't wait that long, you can hear the full thing right now and even watch the video version of this chat on our Patreon. All the details to sign up are at theretrohour.com. We'll see you next Friday.